kind of a mixture.
Three universities means they specialize in different areas of knowledge.
They're in the big. There's a community college. There's a Metro State College.
Community colleges, college. That means
a
for
year.
That means
2 year college only. Then it's Metro State College of Denver, which is a four year college. It's confusing. And then there's a 4 year university all and they're all independent, but they call this their rarer campus.
Okay. I was just flipping through the pages of a brochure about Denver, and it said that there's more graduates in this city than any other city in America, which is surprising because it's not that big a city compared to New York or LA. So, highly educated bunch over here. I need Prabhupada's books more. Okay, so, well, you look like a student who's familiar with Krishna consciousness. There are certain symptoms that suggest that. I'm also an anthropologist. Apart from being expert in predicting the future, I can also tell if someone has bead bag and shaved head. Shika there also?
No.
And they should have a certain kind of happy smile on their face, and then they're definitely devotees of Krishna. I heard this years ago, actually, that they used to arrest our devotees in the airports in New York or whatever for distributing books. So the security or whatever it was, they were told how to recognize those evil Hare Krishna devotees who are distributing their horrible books. You have to look out for someone who's got a baseball, young men with baseball caps, a huge bag that's far too heavy for any normal human being to carry, and this big smile on their face. If you see such a person, arrest them immediately.
Wow.
If you see anyone who looks too happy, you know it must be a Hare Krishna devotee. Yourself?
Yeah, I am.
You're associated with the devotees?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're familiar with Krishna consciousness?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. And yourself?
I'm in the Bhakti Club. Bhakti Club.
You're just in the Bhakti Club.
That's and I read and I chant.
That's wonderful.
But I do, the movement in which I come from, we honor and respect all religious spiritual paths, and one of them is.
I see. I was thinking of speaking something along those lines, actually. So let's start. Having seen the multicultural lounge, I was thinking of talking a little bit about multiculturalism.
Hmm.
So, Kartal? Karotal. Kara means hand, and tal means beat. So this is Kartal. This is also Kartal. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Yeah, just as we were navigating our way to this remote corner of the building, we saw a sign indicating the multicultural lounge. I was just trying to imagine what a multicultural lounge might be. And it led me to think a bit about this term multicultural. Presumably, what are you an instructor in?
That's funny you asked. I'm a diversity multiculturalism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
so I better ask you if what I'm saying is correct. That I don't really know much about it, but presumably the multiculturalism implies the concept of respecting different cultures and not being dogmatically attached to anyone and appreciating all different cultures. So I was thinking a little bit about this because in my childhood, what we used to see on, I was born in England, so we used to see the on TV, the news, the demonstrations, and Martin Luther King, and how there was this, it wasn't called apartheid as in South Africa, I don't think they used that term, but it was practically the same thing. So that legally it is established that all persons have equal rights. I believe that according to standard Christian theology, women only got souls around the end of the 19th century. And they're all, I'm not sure what to say because I'm not from this country. I just came a few days ago. But one time they were called Negroes and then Blacks. And now I think it's Afro-Americans now.
Now African-Americans.
The thing is that the fact that this term is always changing suggests that it's not really multiculturalism, because they don't want to use the word Negroes, because although it's clear what that means, but it's become a pejorative term, so they change it to Blacks, and then that became a pejorative. Whatever, you have to keep on changing the term to try to not have some unkind overtones. So that really shows that bias is still there. I was reading somewhere recently there's some movement to control the immigration into America. That it should be mostly, they want to keep it mostly whites. They never changed that term, did they? White, that term stays the same. It should just remain whites, because we don't want America to change the basic culture of America to be dominated by non-whites. What could be worse? So these different cultural considerations are going on, and in the universities especially, I think this multiculturalism is being promoted with the idea of trying to see the good in all different cultures and all different peoples. So I was thinking about that, because Srila Prabhupada, he, in one of his seminal statements about this Krishna conscious movement, said that we should not present Krishna conscious as a religious movement, but as a scientific, philosophical, and not as a religion, but as a scientific, philosophical, and cultural movement meant for the re-spiritualization of the world. So three terms are there: scientific, the whole of modern science is it's practically changed the whole course of civilization, science and technology. Philosophy, there's not much philosophy in the world these days. Not many people are interested in philosophy. We don't find many people. Do you find many people interested in philosophy?
Not so many.
Mostly people are interested in going to the bar and rock concerts and this and that. And serious thinking about the purpose of life is not. Most people are not very interested in that. Then culture. Culture has such a profound effect on the way we behave and the way we think. So the Krishna conscious movement is attempting to present the culture of the spiritual world, that people can live in this world in a manner to prepare themselves to enter the spiritual world. Because there's spiritual culture. I spoke extensively a few days ago about this, about Krishna conscious culture as compared to materialistic culture. That whatever cultures are going on in the world, they may be considered to have developed, and you don't have to be an anthropologist, they say that the culture, they develop, the cultures change in course of time due to different social influences and Even economic influences, the way people dress is influenced by their work, and in the modern age it's much influenced by the fashion industry. There are so many influences which affect the culture, but Krishna conscious culture is different to all these cultures because it is the culture of the spiritual world. It's not, of course, according to anthropologists, it's something the Vedic culture or the Hindu culture or Indian culture, whatever you want to call it, it is also evolved. But the Krishna conscious understanding is that it's a culture given by God, a set of rules and covering every aspect of life that trains us to act in such a way that we can enter the spiritual world, just like this wearing a sari. That is the culture of the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, there's women wear saris. Now, I'm very interested in cultural issues within our movement, because within our Krishna conscious movement, because Srila Prabhupada necessarily, when he introduced Krishna consciousness in the Western world, made some adjustments. He didn't attempt to introduce Krishna consciousness in such a manner, rigidly, as it would be in the Indian cultural ethos. For instance, he saw that many young women at that time were interested in Krishna consciousness. Now, in India, it wouldn't be acceptable for them to live in an ashram with men, because they have to live according to the ancient culture, they have to live under the protection of their fathers or husbands, or when they're older, younger sons. But Srila Prabhupada saw that there's a completely different culture here, and that if women are not given the opportunity to live in the ashram, it'll be very difficult for them to practice Krishna consciousness. So he gave them that opportunity. But at the same time, Srila Prabhupada wanted, as far as possible, to introduce this original Vedic culture, because that is conducive for developing Krishna consciousness. We can see that the modern American culture, of course, when we use the term culture, it's a very amorphous kind of term, but still we can in general terms talk about American culture, although there are so many different subcultures within that culture. But we can say that the general American culture is based on getting money and spending it, consumerism. If you want to break American culture down to two facets, it's based on work hard, get money, if you don't work hard, shoot someone, somehow or other get some money, and then enjoy it, and that's it. That's the basis of modern American culture. It's set on a worldview. However, even if that worldview isn't specifically defined, but the goal of Vedic culture can be summarized in two lines, that smaran nityam anityatvam kuru punya ahoratra, that we should always remember that everything here is temporary, therefore we should day and night incessantly perform activities that are for our ultimate benefit, not simply for the immediate benefit of what I can cram in my mouth, what I can enjoy through my skin, what sounds I can hear. That we should always be hearing some music, something should come in our ear, whether we're driving or whether we're eating, always something, I should hear something pleasurable, and we should always have some pleasure on our tongue. When we're not eating, we should be chewing some gum or drinking some Coca-Cola or smoking some cigarette. That constantly the senses should be titillated. This idea is there. But the Vedic culture is based rather on the principle of sense control, which is actually in Vedic education, this is the first principle, sense control. For brahmacharis, the first principle is sense control. And girls are traditionally, they're educated at home, so they're also taught chastity, That is the most important cultural or behavioral aspect they have to learn. So that also means self-control. Mm-hmm. Without that, then young people, they're without self-control, they're not self-control. So that was a profound statement. It actually is. Without the endeavor for self-control, and then the mind is totally wild. And we see that the students in the universities, that even though the universities are supposed to be bastions of learning and culture, but actually the behavior of the what do you think? It's multiculturally mad. Their behavior is of the students is such that in many schools I heard they have like guards at the door searching. Is that right? They have to search the kids for drugs and weapons. So without teaching, without having a clear goal of what the ultimate purpose of life is, that the ultimate purpose of life is not to enjoy this body, but rather to transcend the bodily demands and understand that we are not the body, we are spirit soul, we are spiritual living beings, and our real self-interest is not in indulging the body. Without this information, then whatever education is there simply is educates us. It increases our ignorance, actually. It increases our ignorance of the real goal of life. It serves as a covering over knowledge of the real goal of life. This Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, Joro Bidya Joto Mayar Bhaibhav Tomar Bhajane Badha Anitya Sangsare Moha Janameya Jivke Kare Gadha. Who knows this word Gadha? What it means? It means a donkey. So it's a Joro Vidya, this materialistic education, materialistic knowledge. Joro Vidya Joto Mayar Bhaibhav. It is simply another display of illusion. Joro Vidya Joto Mayar Bhaibhav. And it is an obstacle in cultivation of transcendental devotional service to Krishna. Because it covers, when we fill our head with knowledge which is not in relationship to Krishna, we tend to think that this is very important. Just like geologists think it's very important to go to different parts of the world and dig up different kinds of rocks and make different kinds of speculations about, well, this must have landed by meteorite and this one got blown from a volcano 2,000 kilometers away and this one came up from the center of the earth, and which is, might be very interesting, and that's only one area of study, and there's so many areas of study. But by considering this important, we neglect the really important question of who am I, where have I come from, what is the purpose of life, what happens after death, who is God, what is our relationship with Him. So it becomes an obstacle, and we, by being absorbed in that, then we think that understanding who is God, what is our relationship with Him, what is Krishna consciousness, we think this is not very important. So many times I used to, when I was traveling by train in India, go through the carriages showing people Prabhupada's books, and often we find the students, they're studying very seriously. In India still many of the students study seriously. And here, I don't know. They study seriously? Some of them. Not so seriously. It's like, I was just telling you how I wasn't going to university and everyone was trying to convince me to go. So what I finally decided not to... What was the final thing? I mean, I was still thinking maybe 2% I should go, and everyone's trying to convince me. And one teacher, as a final way to try to convince me, said, well, at least you can get government funding just to fool around for 4 years. And I thought, well, that's it. I'm definitely not going, because I don't want to just fool around and waste my life, even with government funding.
I guess it depends on the student's motive.
Yeah, yeah. In the trains I saw the Indians, they're busy studying the calculus or whatever it is, and when you try to show them, no, don't disturb me, they feel, oh, it's a very bad thing you've done. You're disturbing me. I've got something important to do here. And here we have the journey of self-discovery. This is not important. But no, they can't even look at it. They can't see it. So it becomes a great obstacle in finding out what is the actual purpose of life. We become interested. There's so many things in this world, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur also says in his many, many songs. If we can teach the students Bhaktivinoda Thakur's writings, that will be very valuable for them. So he says, Keshav, Krishna, Keshav tua jagat bichitra. O Keshav, your universe that you have created, it is amazing, multidimensional. There's so many things to study. Just like, for instance, if we were to study this, is it plastic or what is it? Plastic, is it? Some kind of paper with some kind of wax covering, is it? You studied it in the university? Okay. Well, actually you could. You could write maybe a dozens of PhD theses just based on this. That who has discovered or who has designed how to make paper of just the right density so that you can form it like this, and it even has a rim and it even has a little bottom like that. It's very well designed. How you to make the machine to that designs this, and then you have to consider what's the right size for people, you know, big size, small size. It's about the smallest size they make them, isn't it? And then how to cover it with wax, and what kind of wax, and it won't be poisonous, we hope. And then you have to get permission, a license to produce it. Will it be commercially viable? Where to get the paper from? You can get different tenders from different suppliers. And then how to market it, and what's the chemical composition of the paper, and you can go on and on and on. And will it hold boiling water without the wax melting, or so many considerations. So everything in the world, there's so many things. So you can get completely absorbed in any area of knowledge. So this is an obstacle. These are obstacles. Becoming absorbed in mundane knowledge is an obstacle in our cultivation of the real knowledge of what is the actual purpose of life. Toma bhajane bhada. Anitya shangshay. We don't know. This material existence, everything here is temporary. We don't consider that even if I can work out what are the... I can understand that how to make paper cups, you also have to consider federal or state laws about... Maybe they have some laws about how to make it so that it has to be... biodegradable and all this kind of thing. So, considering all these points, but we don't consider that I can make the best, most economic or financially, commercially lucrative paper cups in the whole of the United States of America. God bless America. God bless American paper cups. They're probably imported anyway. But anyway, you're going to have to die. So you might get your obituary in the paper. Inventor of the best paper cups. Yeah. Not likely. Maybe you'll have your obituary put in the newspaper. And then the body will be burned. And you never know, after a few generations, some of the ashes having degraded into the soil, they might have become part of a tree, and they might be end up in a paper cup. But what happens to you, the person? People are not thinking. Anitta shangsai, everything here is temporary. Moha janamiya, all this acquirement of knowledge, it simply gives birth to more illusion. And jeev, we are the jiva, we are not the body, we're the soul within the body. But it makes us into a big ass, the word is called. Jeev ke kariye gata. This, the scholar of that, which is not of our actual interest is compared to an ass, because an ass, of course, probably in this country they're just, whatever asses are kept as pets, right? But, but traditionally they are beasts of burden. So they, just like in India, you'll see a man driving a whole group of, you've seen, they drive a whole group of asses to the river with big piles of clothing. Or they'll you'll see them coming from the forest with the ass, with big pile of wood. So the ass is just, you know, a little skinny creature with a big pile on their back. So they're carrying this pile of clothing or wood or whatever it may be. But it doesn't do any benefit to them. It doesn't benefit them at all to carry all this. So therefore they're called an ass. If you want to insult someone, you call them an ass. Because an ass is considered a foolish creature. So in the same way, we carry loads of information in our heads, which is of no ultimate benefit to us. So I got a little diverted there from multiculturalism, but it's the same point that it's a noble endeavor, no doubt, to improve human society. And certainly it is better that we be tolerant or accommodating to or even welcoming of various cultures within human society, instead of this pig-headed attitude that only my group is the best. I was born in, let's think of Estonia. Therefore, Estonia is the best country in the world. It must be because I was born there. That's the proof. So, this kind of feeling that this born of, in Sanskritum that's called Aham Mama Bhav, I, me and mine. So broad-mindedness, that is better. It is not good to hate people simply because they're not from the same cultural, ethnic or religious group than us. However, one point is that if this multicultural ethic had not been promoted, then it would have been more difficult to preach this Krishna consciousness. And we find that even now it's difficult to even begin to preach Krishna consciousness in societies which are closed societies, like in the so-called People's Republic of China, mainland China, or in countries like Libya, or where they're called Islamic states, and they don't allow other. Actually, in some of these countries, I know in Pakistan, it's actually not only is it an offense to preach another religion to a Muslim, which means most of the population, but if you're found guilty of doing so, then the mandatory punishment, that means the judge has no option but to punish you with death, specifically by hanging. So it's not a very open society, you could say. So Srila Prabhupada appreciated that America had given him the opportunity to preach Krishna consciousness here. Although there was a lot of opposition at one time, in general open-armed ethic. That even at that time, there was, Prabhupada came in 1965, and America wasn't as liberal or multicultural as now, but still, it was much more, because America has traditionally been considered a cultural melting pot. So all different cultures come together. However, there can be some. Although this approach is certainly better than this racial or ethnic bigotry, still it's not complete. I put this to your consideration. It's not complete because assuming that we should just accept all different cultures and everyone live together peacefully, it means that we fail to ask the question of what, if we say that all paths or all ways of living are acceptable, then the tendency is to fail. On one side, there's the tendency to fail to see that what is the actual purpose of life and what is the best way that we should live to fulfill that purpose. And on the other side, there's a tendency in the name of respecting everyone to fail to uphold any basic principles. Now, there in America, I think probably more than in any other, I think almost certainly than in any other country in the world, and it's also reflected within our movement, in America especially, there is, on one side, multiculturalism, but at the same time, there's an increasing cultural divide between those who may be broadly called the conservatives and the liberals. And even that's in the political sphere, the Republicans and the Democrats. That the Republicans, they tend to stand for Christianity, especially Protestant Christianity, and especially what might be called fundamentalist or Protestant Christianity, and what might be called traditional Christian values, many of which are also subscribed to by the Krishna conscious movement, such as Christian family values, no abortion, not very favorable towards homosexuality, like this. Whereas in the liberal voice is one of within certain limits, not trying to set any standards, but rather allowing people to choose their own standards, not trying to impose morality on others, but letting people choose their own way of life, which sounds better. But on the other hand, what we practically see is that there's, without teaching morality or discipline, the tendency is for people to degrade. That if we just believe in the inherent goodness of the human race, that we don't need to train them in anything, then the tendency is for them to degrade, to be more and more animalistic. There was a book that, before I escaped from school, there was a book I read that we were supposed to study, The Lord of the Flies by William Faulkner. I think that was the name of it. I'm not sure if I got the right name of the book. But anyway, I remember some book that we studied. And it gave the story of some children that were marooned on some island. And what happened, without any adult supervision, within a short time, the biggest and strongest, who was called Piggy, he just dominated the others, and he was like a dictator or a despot. And just before some adults came and rescued them from the island, he'd started to kill some of the children because they weren't doing what he wanted them to do. So the moral of the story was that without supervision and without training, that human nature is not inherently good. That the tendency is might makes right. Whoever has got the biggest brawn, they can control others. So there have been attempts by the United Nations to regulate by education and by attempts like the United Nations to regulate this might makes right syndrome, which Hitler was the epitome of. But then one of the forces instrumental in overcoming Hitler was in the same category, namely Stalin. So anyway, they made the United Nations, they made the United Nations Charter of Human Rights in an attempt to establish principles better than the animalistic principle of might makes right. It is, after all, an animalistic principle. Whoever's the strongest, they should rule. But practically speaking, we see the United Nations is a failure. And many countries perceive that. Actually, Prabhupada said that the United Nations was America is cheating the world through the United Nations by attempting to show that we give you all rights, but actually we just want to dominate. Mm. And that's actually happened, that we see that when the United Nations doesn't agree with America's outlook, they just say to the United Nations and just jump into Iraq anyway. Because in the name of humanitarianism and this and that, and they just jumped right in there. And so the liberal ethic is that people should be allowed to choose to do what they like to some degree. If someone chooses, if they think, well, I think that what I want to do is to get a submachine gun and walk into a school and kill a bunch of people, that will be considered wrong according to the humanistic outlook. Now, the conservative outlook is governed by scriptural laws, that these are the laws of God. One should follow the laws of God. But the liberal outlook, that is governed by the humanistic outlook. Humanism denies that there's any God, and that the goal of human society is that everyone should, without believing in any God, we should all live together and act together in the best possible manner for the peaceful living and advancement of the human race. So that idea is there. Now, in America, the liberal and conservative wings have come into a clash, because the conservatives, for instance, find that abortion, they find it wrong. Okay, there's no way it can be accepted. But then, according to the liberal outlook, then a woman should have the right to control her body. The fetus that's forming within her womb is part of the woman's body. This is how they reason. And therefore, if she wants to abort that pregnancy, she should have the right to. Or it's considered that homosexuals, they have feelings towards each other similar to heterosexuals, and then why shouldn't they be allowed to engage in marriage? And well, even in the churches, that argument has come. But the traditional Christian, not only the argument, but they actually have gay marriages in churches and gay bishops and all this kind of thing. So there's a great argument over which is right. Now, the Krishna Conscious Movement, actually in cultural terms, we're closer to the conservative side. Although it's a kind of paradox that the liberals with the multiculturalism would be more willing to accept the Krishna Conscious Movement rather than the conservatives, who would give God a hand in throwing us into hell as soon as possible. Why should God do all the work? We'll save him the work. We'll throw them there to burn forever. Because we failed to bathe ourselves in the blood of Jesus. Which sounds rather macabre. But the Krishna consciousness movement operates on the principle that there is God, that everything in this world is not simply going on by chance, as the Darwinists or neo-Darwinists would have us believe, and that although many cultures in the world could be said to have evolved, there are actual standards of human behavior which are given by God in Scripture. So many of these standards, they parallel that of traditional Christians. But actually there are many, many points in Vedic culture which go much deeper than the Christian tradition. And along with the Vedic culture, there is a defined Vedic philosophy which describes who is God, what is our relationship with Him, and how we should act within that relationship. So there are so many rules and regulations of Vedic life which teach us how to live in this world so that we can be healthy, mentally adjusted, so that we can act most productively according to our psychophysical capacities. It recognizes a distinct difference between the psychophysical makeup of men and women and prescribes different roles for them accordingly. And in this way, gives guidelines so that everyone can achieve the purpose of life, which is not to get born in any human culture ever again, but to attain to the spiritual world, and where the spiritual culture of singing, dancing, and serving Krishna goes on eternally. Where the culture of eternal bliss in association with Krishna is continued at every moment, the natural culture of the soul. So there are so many cultures in human society, and so many laws have been made, and so many different theories of how to live, capitalism and communism and socialism, and so many, there are always different adjustments in society. One government will come in and increase the welfare spending, and then another government will come in and decrease it, or they'll increase on one side and decrease on another side. They're always trying to adjust everything in different ways. But the Vedic culture, it is... Actually, in the Vedic culture, there's no system of making laws, because the laws are already given. What there is the king, rather than electing a peanut farmer one time and a B-movie actor the next time, who basically, they have to be a showman. The president is basically a showman, that's all. They're not pulling the strings. They're good TV personality, that's all. One who can make you feel good, who can make you feel fuzzy inside. That's the job of the president. So in Vedic culture, they trained people how to rule. It wasn't that you just... There's this argument against Kerry, right? That he's only been a governor one time, I think, is it? Something like that?
He's a senator.
Senator, yeah. But only one time or something like that. Oh no, it's the deputy for him. Right, he's only been in one time. So he's not experienced. So they say, well, how can you, you're not supposed to learn on the job in the White House. You should know, have some idea about what you're doing. So, in Vedic culture, the Kshatriyas, it's found out astrologically, and actually training by birth. We talk about the blue blood. They were trained. There was this, just like we see, there are different kinds of horses. Some are good for race horses, some are good for pack horses, for carrying weight, some are good for just riding around. There are different breeds. There are different breeds of dogs. The Labradors, they make good guide dogs. The Collie dogs, they're good for rounding up the sheep. And then, what other kinds of dogs? There are different, the Alsatian are good for guard dogs. And what are they called? Rottweilers, they're good for if you don't want to be friends with your neighbors or something like that. So a different, but you'll find that if you breed the dog, the same breed, they have certain characteristics, isn't it? If you say Alsatian in this country, they call them German shepherds. Mm. Right? They have certain characteristics. If you see there's an Alsatian, you'll be a little bit cautious about entering that house, because you know they're very faithful to their master, but they can be vicious otherwise. So dogs, they're bred and they have different characteristics. So similarly, the Kshatriyas, the royal families, they by birth they had some inherent characteristics. We see that Parikshit Maharaj, when he was born, Yudhishthira Maharaj was very anxious to know, will he uphold the principles of our royal tradition? Will he be noble? Will he protect the citizens? Will he be protect means he should be capable to protect. By his hands he should be ready to fight. He should not be sending messages to the troops. He should be out there in front. That's his message. Out in front. He should be the first one. The king in a battle, he should be the first one to get injured. He should be out there at the front. No. So the king, he's a trained leader. But he's trained by brahmanas who train him that even though you have might, that might is not your right. You have to rule on behalf of dharma. You have to rule on behalf, so that people, the society can be ordered so that everyone, swakarmanatam abhyatya siddhim vindati manavaha, that so that everyone can live in human society, and by performing their work they can achieve the perfection of life by worshipping God. So that Vedic culture should be upheld by the Kshatriyas. And the laws were already given, but how to apply them in any different situation, because life is such that there are so many different, even in a simple society, what to speak of modern complex society, there's so many different situations arise. How to apply the law? That they would have a council of advisors, brahmanas. And these brahmanas, they would not gain anything materially from being, even though they're associated with the king, there were no kickbacks. They would live very simply. They would have to live very simply. They didn't get any pay. Just they got a little food, clothing like this. So that it was seen they had no personal interest in giving advice. Simply they studied the Vedic literatures and they gave advice to the king. How to rule society so that everyone can progress towards the ultimate goal of life. So this Vedic culture, it's a, rather than something being evolved and we're trying to find out what's the best way to live from the human plane, rather it is a culture coming down, given by God to us, so that we can live in this world and understand Him. So we want to introduce this Vedic culture, Krishna conscious culture, that ethnocentrism, that is not good. Simply to consider that we are best, because we are we. We are who we are, and we are best, and we don't like others. So that is not very good. But even multiculturalism, appreciating other cultures, but without asking the vital question of human life, atato brahma jignyasa, what is the absolute truth? That is incomplete. If we simply tolerate others' modes of living, but we don't find out the way of living which will actually fulfill the purpose of human life, then it's also incomplete. So, we would like to introduce Vedic multiculturalism. That the real United Nations, United Nations or the world, cannot unite on a platform of wishful thinking. But if we all understand that there is one Supreme Father, who is Krishna, and that whatever bodies we may find ourselves in, whatever color the skin may be, or whatever cultures we may have been born into, we are all eternally related as parts and parcels of Krishna. And that humanism is certainly incomplete because it doesn't take into account that not only humans are part and parcel of Krishna, but all living beings are. We have no right to kill animals in the slaughterhouse simply for the titillation of the taste buds. So we find that there are movements also nowadays that are concerned with the whole earth, the whole ecosystem. Greenpeace is a famous movement that is, it's an activist movement that tries to stop the ecological rape of the earth. But even that is incomplete. Because if we're thinking that we will maintain the earth very nicely for future generations, but what for? So that we can all live here peacefully, forgetting Krishna. Then it's also incomplete. Without understanding actually who we are, that we are eternal spirit souls, we are not the body, which we can, that can, by simple logic, that can be deduced. Without understanding that, then all attempts, all human endeavors to live in a very fair way, in a very considerate way, they're all doomed to failure, actually. The failure will be that, however much we have protected the whales, or stopped active anti-vivisection, there are so many causes that we can take up. Save the whale, anti-vivisection, save the Amazon, so many different causes. Stop the pollution. But however much we take this up, if we fail to understand that human life is meant for God realization, and that this is the ultimate purpose of life, then all these endeavors, they serve no real purpose. If we live in a very pollution-free atmosphere, but we live very close to nature, but we don't realize what the actual purpose of life is, to understand what is our relationship with Krishna, then we may, in a very natural, ecologically integrated manner, waste our lives, that's all. But actually, if we do take to Krishna consciousness, then all these things will follow. Just like the exploitation of the earth for commercial purposes won't take place if we're Krishna conscious. Because if we understand that the purpose of life is Krishna conscious, we won't waste our time in unnecessary economic development. Everything that is required to maintain the human body, food, clothing and shelter, is by God's grace, it is provided in most parts of the world. Everywhere there is some, in every part of the world there are some natural ingredients that can be used for building houses to shelter us against the inclemency of the weather. Just like everywhere we'll find there's wood or rocks or mud that can be shaped into buildings. Of course, now here in Colorado, there's tornado danger. So what was there traditionally? What did the Native Americans do about that? Were there forests here previously? That would be good against tornadoes if there were forests. What did they do? What? How did they live? Yeah, but they didn't have any building materials to protect it. There's a stone.
Some depends on the nations that they were from, but depends on what area. In the Midwest, teepees.
Teepee, yeah.
And many of those teepees could stand.
They could withstand, yeah.
They were built
like that. They knew how to do it. It may seem like a very simple structure, but people were in harmony with nature. And they, without having to make lots of research, they knew how to live in, they got their food and their clothing and their shelter by the grace of God. So the Krishna Conscious Movement is advocating a more simple way of life. And that everything, wherever we live, can be provided by nature. And actually, many of the natural disturbances come because of we're digging into the earth to unnecessarily take out the oil and we're putting these what's that called, CFCs. It's depleting the ozone layer, and in so many ways the whole natural balance is becoming disturbed. But if we are not ambitious to try to so-called improve our living conditions, but we're anxious to improve our spiritual condition, then we'll be satisfied to live very simply. And actually, I personally lived for many years in the villages in Bangladesh before they had electricity, which they got now, which has changed the culture so much because they have TV. And when you get electricity, then you want all the gadgets that go with it. And then people, they're not content to live simply, and they want to emigrate to the cities to get the money so that they can have the air conditioner because it's so hot in the city. But then if you're living in the village, you have a nice thick walls, mud walls, and nice coconut and palm and trees over the house. So, and the nice winds are blowing, and you have a hand fan. So, and anyway, you just tolerate it. It's hot. Yes, it's hot, but you have a hand fan and you tolerate, that's all. But now people, they can't tolerate anything. They have to have everything. The attempt of the technological society is to adjust everything just perfectly so that we have all facilities for living comfortably. But to make those facilities, we have to work so hard in some job that we don't like. People talk about job satisfaction. Most people don't have job satisfaction. Most people, they wouldn't do their job. If you told them that from now on, we're not going to pay you, then no one would come to work. Is there anyone in America any employee who would come to work if they're told that from now on, no pay? Would anyone come just because they like their work so much?
Very few.
Very few. No, people don't like, most people spend most of their lives doing things that they don't like. Because they're forced to, because they have to get some money so that they can live comfortably. But what comfortable living if most of your life is spent either going to work or coming back or working in some job you don't like, so you can come back and relax in some comfortable seat and adjust the temperature just to how you like it. But then with the air conditioning, then so many other problems come because the viruses, they multiply in that atmosphere, and there are so many problems coming from air conditioning. So in other way, anyway, I'm waffling on a lot here. Srila Prabhupada just put it very succinctly, that modern society is insane. So without all this waffling on, anyone can see that it's a madhouse, that's all. So Prabhupada was advocating a return to a more simple way of life, simple living and high thinking, instead of very elaborate living and thinking. Thinking just like, who's interested in philosophy? Thinking means that no thinking, there's no real thinking. People are not thinking about what is the purpose of life. So high living, especially in Colorado, I guess, high living, very high buildings, very elaborately sophisticated technological society, but thinking, practically speaking, the level of real thinking, of meaningful thinking, most people, even if they have university degrees, their degree of meaningful thinking is less than that of children. Because if we go into schools with young children and speak about Krishna consciousness, we'll find that children have very good questions. You have that experience? The young children, but then as they grow older, then they start to ask questions like, what's this thing on the back of your head? and just very superfluous kind of questions. So this actually shows that the education kills our spiritual instincts, the modern education. It kills our spiritual instincts. And we just become concerned with superfluous things like getting a degree so I can get a better job. And then just enjoy life and drink beer and go to a concert and find a girl, and that's it. So the Krishna Conscious Movement advocates bringing everyone to a higher level of consciousness. This is real multiculturalism. That everyone, whatever culture we may be from, we should come to a higher level of consciousness. Inquire into what is the purpose of life. What are we doing here anyway? If we examine, we'll find that whatever our culture may be, we are simply a space-time worm, as Einstein called it. That if we consider that we're these bodies, then this body is just existing for a blip in time on some tiny little planet, on some tiny little galaxy, we don't know where, somewhere in space. So, if we consider that we are the body, then we're absolutely insignificant. But yet we have an innate tendency to consider that there is some purpose to life. So to find out that, what is the purpose of life? Who am I? What happens after death? So the Krishna Conscious Movement is meant for, first of all, awakening people to even ask these questions, because due to the force of modern lack of culture, lack of any spiritual culture, most people, once they get past the age of 6 or 7, their tendency to even ask these questions is killed. Because by watching TV, then we just think that the world is, that life means eat, sleep, drink, be merry, and enjoy, for tomorrow we shall all be dead. That how to, like I say, to cram as many things as possible into your mouth and enjoy life to the max. Or if we're more cultured on the material platform, we may be into like some kind of, I heard in what's this city, Boulder, there are so many people are into New Age kind of living, but how to live in harmony with nature, and all this kind of thing. But what actually is the purpose of life? The Krishna Conscious Movement is meant for awakening people, first of all, to ask that question, and actually to give the answers. And people may think that this is very egoistic of us to think that, well, how can you say that you have the answers? But then, someone should have the answers. It's not that we're simply living here and that we should be bewildered eternally. Someone should have the answers. So, if others can't give better answers, they should accept these answers. That actually there is God, and He is the Supreme Person. A God is not simply some idea, or some vagueness, some hazy, fuzzy cloud or light, but He is the Supreme Person. And we all have our eternal relationship with Him. And two, that relationship is one of from our side, loving servitude. Love is the most important thing. But love, as conceived of in material consciousness, is not love at all. What people call love, it's simply mutual exploitation. I rub your back and you rub mine. Something like that. So, Krishna consciousness means to teach what is the goal of life, to revive our dormant love for Krishna, and how to practically attain that. There is a system, there is a process. The process does not make us into robots. People think that if we have to follow some process, then we lose our individuality. But actually we already lost our individuality, because we are forced by the laws of karma to sometimes have a body of a human being, sometimes of a dog, sometimes of a tree, sometimes of a cat. So how can we say I have to express my individuality when we're forced to accept different bodies? But rather, our individual nature is as each one of us has a particular individual capacity to serve Krishna. So that needs to be uncovered. The rules and regulations of Krishna consciousness do not stifle our individuality, but they reveal it. Just like, for instance, a ballet dancer, when we see dancing, they dance it appears to be a very free and natural style. And they express themselves through that ballet dancing. But they had to learn that. You just can't jump up there in a drunken stupor and become a... You can dance some kind of way in a drunken stupor, but ballet dancing, you have to learn it under discipline. So that discipline brings out the ability by which one acts in a very natural, free-flowing dance. One has to be trained how to do that. So the ability to do that is there, but training is required on how to do it. In the beginning, one has to follow the discipline, and then later he can dance very freely and naturally. So in the same way, everyone has the inherent tendency to be Krishna conscious. But because at the present time we have lost that culture, we require training in that. We require to follow the discipline so that we can come to the level of spontaneously acting in Krishna's service. And if we don't accept that this culture, then we are forced by the laws of nature to take birth in different species of life. So this Vedic culture, that is actually the root of all cultures that are spread all over the world. We can find, of course this is a very big topic, but we can find that there are traces of Vedic culture all over the world. There have been deities, Vedic deities, been found all over the world. But due to the academic, what is that Sadaputta Prabhu uses that term? Mm-hmm. The academic filter, is it? Is that what he calls it? That that when any artifact or any evidence is found that contradicts the present accepted scientific shibboleth or dogma, that evidence is lost very quickly, somehow or other, or forgotten, or ignored. A few years ago, a Japanese fisherman, there's a photo of they brought to shore a dinosaur, dinosaurs are supposed to be extinct, but they brought from the sea a dinosaur that had just died recently, because the whole body was there, and there's a photo of it. And so it was going to be brought to America for research, but it got lost. You know, it's just a small little thing like a dinosaur, and someone just lost it, you know. So this kind of thing happens. So there have been deities all over the world. In Central America, in Siberia, there have been Vedic deities like Shiva, Ganesh and Vishnu. have been found, but such evidence of Vedic culture being spread all over, I mean, such deities means ancient, they're like hundreds and thousands of years old. They're just the knowledge filter, that's what he calls it.
Yes.
It's just forgotten, or lost, or denied, or ignored. So this goes on. But actually we understand from the Vedic literatures that Vedic culture was spread all over the world. So this is the original culture, and eventually after the time of Maharaj Janamajaya, he was the last king of the whole world. And then eventually all these other cultures came. And practically what happened when the Christian culture took over Europe, they obliterated, they literally destroyed all traces of pre-Christian culture. So, but the pre-Christian culture, which they called pagan, it was actually Vedic. Using different names, like the original Celtic culture, and all these, there's still one area in Russia, that's the capital is Chibuksar, it's one state, Chuasha state, where they still, the people of that state, they still follow their pre-Christian religion. So actually in the Western world it was just destroyed. The library at Constantinople that had a massive library of the knowledge of the ancient world, it was just burned. Because they didn't want that anything would be known but this, that they had the idea that only Christianity is knowledge and that everything else is not knowledge. When the British and other Europeans came to India, they found a problem, because their whole reasoning for going all over the world, well, one reasoning was the merchants, they wanted to make money. But then they had to have some kind of reason for the British Empire to expand and just conquer over different countries. So they said that we are civilizing these peoples. But they in India they found that the knowledge was so deep and the civilization was so much greater than anything persons who were a little bit open-minded, there weren't that many of them, but the knowledge of God that was there was so much greater than anything conceived of in what they call Christianity, although I doubt if Jesus Christ would have anything to do with it, but what they call Christianity. So they made a systematic campaign to rubbish the Vedic culture. And they studied Sanskrit with the aim of attempting to show how this is all rubbish.
Wow.
Although some, they actually appreciated that this is very advanced. So we find that practically that similar culture was going on all over the world. But because the white man had the power of arms, and then they presumed that our own culture, that is the best, and we should conquer over others. So now they're trying to belatedly reverse this with multiculturalism. It's done a lot of damage. Even now not the multiculturalism, but the cultural chauvinism. Because even now the South Asian studies and Indological studies, it used to be called Indology, now they call South Asian studies. Because India is now, they say Indological, but India is now India, Bangladesh, it used to be one, but now it's India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Nepal, Sri Lanka, it all became separate, Burma. So the basic principles or the basic or the fundamental and suppositions on which it's based, it's the same tradition is coming on from the 19th century Indologists, whose purpose in studying the Vedas was to belittle it. And they have, there's so many To uphold their theory. They have so many funny ideas. Just like they say that they talk about the prototype Indo-European language, which they say there must have been an original Indo-European language from which all the other languages like Sanskrit and all others have come. There's no evidence whatsoever, just their imagination, that such a language exists. Another thing the anthropologists say, I'm just waffling a little bit here on different things. So another thing, the anthropologists say that we can understand the level of a culture, the development of a culture, according to its language. If the language is complex, then we can understand that the thinking processes and the culture of that society is very complex. But Sanskrit is the most complex language in the world, and it's an ancient language. So it totally contradicts their theories, because it should be that that originally there should have been, according to the Darwinistic anthropology, then originally then there should have been just and that gradually got got refined to pass the meat or something like that, or hit him on the head, and that gradually got refined into our modern pluralistic society. And so the idea is that we're now living at the acme of human society. But Sanskrit is an ancient language, and it's highly complex. So it actually, that in itself debunks all their theories. And there's so much knowledge in the Vedic literature. Just that you can predict the positions of the stars using modern astronomy. You can also do so using Vedic astronomy. And astronomy was a key subject in the Vedic culture, because by according to the positions of the stars, they would choose times for performing, auspicious times for performing all activities, of which yajna was the most essential activity in Vedic culture. So study of astronomy was essential in Vedic culture. And although Vedic cosmology is quite different to that of modern cosmology, nevertheless, they had much knowledge. They had names for all the different planets. And although the descriptions of how the planets moved is different to that of modern astronomy, quite different, but still they had considerable knowledge of how the planets were moving. So just for instance, they had considerable knowledge of how the body works and how to fix it up when it goes wrong, medical knowledge. And then knowledge which by the modern system of procuring knowledge, the knowledge of yoga, that is not there at all in the modern academic system. So in Vedic culture, there were so many different branches of knowledge, plus branches of knowledge that we don't have nowadays. Now you may think, well, that was, when we hear of they're fighting with bows and arrows, and you might think, well, that's just like people out of the jungle. But their fighting with bows and arrows was actually far more advanced than the modern warfare, because they're fighting with arrows. The arrow, it wasn't just like, even in Mayapur. Have you seen in Mayapur, in the area of Mayapur? You'll still see some Adivasis, they're called. They live in the jungle and they're practically naked, and they go around with bows and arrows.
Wow. So,
even in, you see, if you go on Navadvip Dham Parikrama, sometimes they don't mix with civilized people so much, really, but sometimes you come across them. So, but the Arjunas fighting with bow and arrow wasn't like these people who they have no education or any such thing. They just hunt for rabbits and this and that. But by mantra, he could from the arrow would be charged with power. So one arrow, it could go and go through the bodies of different soldiers and come back, and he'd use it again. or by mantra, he would make the arrow would be surcharged with power to make everything hot or cold or water or wind. So like this, it was very specific, and they could call it back also. So by mantra, but that power is not there anymore, because people, that power of mantra, that comes from people who perform austerities, and in modern society people don't perform austerities, they perform sinful activities. Therefore people's ability to perceive and manipulate the subtle is gone, and therefore they are concerned with perceiving and manipulating the gross. So anyway, like I say, I'm waffling on a bit here, but the point is that Vedic culture, even from the material point of view, is very advanced. Of course I was talking about killing with arrows, but that also, who to fight, not just the fighting should be on religious principles. If a person attacks with no good reason, they simply want to dominate, then there should be persons in society to protect others. Therefore the science of warfare was developed, really for defense, not for self-aggrandizement. So this Vedic culture, actually it's the most, there's no comparison, even on a material platform. And it's meant for understanding the ultimate purpose of life. So as you are concerned with culture, I request you to study this Vedic culture. It's a very advanced culture. The present Krishna conscious movement is meant not simply to introduce some dogmatic or sectarian religion, but it is supposed to present with scientific and philosophical reasoning a culture in which everyone can live and attain the highest knowledge of the purpose of life, which is to stop getting reborn and to go to the spiritual world to live with Krishna eternally. So it's a very big subject. But we request that you can study this. That there may be many different cultures and we may respect them all, but still we have to see that some cultures are more advanced than others. Actually, I wrote a paragraph that got published in this Time magazine.
No, really?
About American culture, because there was a big article trumpeting about America, how American hegemony all over the world, how America is dominating the world. And I wrote it and they published it. Where's that book? I put it in this book.
Wow.
I re-quoted it in this book. The Glimpses of Traditional Indian Life. They had to edit it. It was better before they edited it. But they felt they had to give their editors some work to do. Here it is. I opened it on the right page. So in the article, the lead article was on American economic, military, and cultural hegemony. So accompanying photos showed the McDonald's arch in Beijing and Coca-Cola on sale in rural Pakistan. So this letter by my fallen self appeared in the Time European edition, September the 1st, 1997. It goes as follows after they changed it. McDonald's and Coca-Cola symbolize a grossly materialistic civilization centered on profit-making and mindless enjoyment. That America is foisting this type of anti-culture on other countries is nothing to be proud of. Traditional religious, family, and social values are being crushed by the relentless steamroller of Western culture. Aestheticism and finer sentiments are subjugated to lust, violence, and endless passion for material things. America, take another look at yourself, lest you go down in history as the most exploitive and intellectually decrepit civilization ever. So this is our answer to America. Traditional Indian culture. Hare Krishna. I'll finish my waffle there. And the essence of all this is chant Hare Krishna and be happy. That was the message. Are there any questions about all this? It's called Glimpses of Traditional Indian Life, as seen through the eyes of people who lived in it. It's interviews with Indian devotees who are brought up in a traditional devotional way, and also my own reminiscence, cultural reminiscences of the years I spent in the culture of Bangladesh.
Can you get that book here in the United
States? Yes, it's available right here now.
Oh, okay.
You're talking about the academic,
in the
wing of ISKCON.
Is this like too dangerous?
Going into academia with the idea of preaching Krishna consciousness, it's like entering the lion's den.
Yeah.
If you're capable of fighting with lions and subjugating them, please do so. If not, please don't, because you'll get mauled. In other words, the academic ethos is antithetical to Krishna consciousness, which means to receive knowledge from the Vedic literatures. But the modern academic ethos is based on the principle that we receive knowledge by examining everything in the world around us and hypothesizing according to our own intelligence. And a very important part or a cornerstone of the modern academic ethos is that there is no absolute knowledge. We're always trying to find something better and adjusting our theories. So it doesn't admit of there being any academic, or there being absolute knowledge. And if any claims to absolute knowledge are immediately rejected by the modern academic method, the methodology doesn't allow of absolute knowledge, because it would put all the educationists out of a job for a start, because their whole system of education is based on we're trying to find this and that, and it's a matter of my opinion against your opinion, and no one can really know. But we say, why not? Why you're endeavoring so much for knowledge, why should there not be perfect knowledge? Definitely, we agree that you cannot get perfect knowledge simply through the mind and senses, but that there is knowledge from beyond the mind and senses, transcendental knowledge. So transcendental knowledge is not admitted in the modern cultural ethos. Actually, the universities were first founded in Europe for studying the scriptures. That's what they were founded for. But then gradually they became, with the what happened is that gradually scientific knowledge contradicted that which was given by Christian dogma, beginning with Copernicus, who discovered, or appeared to discover, that the earth is not the center of the universe, and that the sun doesn't go around the earth, but the earth goes around the sun. Of course, much later, with relativity theory, nothing's really going, we can't really say that anything's going around anything, or we could as much say the sun is going around the earth as the earth around the sun. But these kind of endeavors turned the academic world upside down, and they became a divide between science and religion, and science won, because the biggest and most prominent established religion in the Western world, the Catholic Church, they have officially taken the position that we have much to learn from modern science. So they're going around licking the boots of the scientists. The scientists aren't licking the... They're not asking the religionists to, you please accept our scientific theory. They don't give a damn for them. They just accept. They just say, religion, we don't care for you. We're scientists. But the religionists are coming around and saying, this, please scientists, accept us also. So they lost. They lost. And the educational institutions are bastions of academic atheism, actually. Of course, they have in America, more than any other place, they have universities which are run by religions, but even those have mostly been overcome by academic agnosticism. So it's a very pernicious kind of ethos. If we go into it, and they won't let you write. You have to write. If you're going to write anything, you have to write it in their terms. You can't write that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You can't write that if you're going to present a paper in the university. You have to write that according to the Gaudiya Vaishnav school, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And you have to treat the Gaudiya Vaishnav school as just one among others. You're not allowed to take an absolute viewpoint. You're not allowed. It's just not allowed. So, Sangat Sanjayate Kamaha, our desires and develop according to our association. It's very bad association. So we have to see if those who are going into the academic system, if they're actually able to bring people to Krishna consciousness, or if they will, by going into the academic system, try to bring this kind of this kind of non-absolutism into Krishna consciousness, which then is not Krishna consciousness. Then we just accept that Krishna consciousness is just another opinion among many. And then it's not Krishna consciousness anymore. Take it or leave it. Yeah, please.
Why do you think that, you know, the story you were telling about how throughout the world in a lot of societies, because I do agree with you, I spent about 3 months last year in China and I saw Vedic, deities there, over there, in a lot of places in China when I was there.
Yeah.
Why do you think, I have my own theory, but I'm just wondering, what do you think? Why do you think in a lot of societies they were trying to crush the Vedic type of influences?
Even in India?
Yeah, why do you think now, that is so?
Well, that is, the first thing when you say, why do you think, that brings what I was talking about, the modern academic approach, that immediately comes into clash with the Vedic approach. Because we don't say, why do you think or why do you believe? But rather we accept that there is knowledge which is given by God in the form of the Vedic literature, and that is knowledge. So it's not really dependent upon what I think or what my theory is, because my theory must be limited by the incompleteness of my intelligence and my own biases and ambitions and all these different things. In the Vedic literature it said that a materialistically conditioned person cannot have perfect knowledge because he has the four defects of imperfect senses. So even what we observe may be wrong. The tendency to be illusioned, even the data that we collect, we may interpret it all wrongly. The tendency to make mistakes, and the cheating propensity, which means that even though we know that our theory is wrong, still we propagate it because we want to get the research grant or something like that. So it's not exactly what we think, but according to the Vedic understanding, we are presently in Kali Yuga, which means the age of hypocrisy. So the age of hypocrisy and irreligion. So this culture, which is so much beneficial to the world, has been deliberately suppressed because people have very gross material motives and they don't want the goodness of this Vedic culture. They want to suppress it. So it's due to the influence of this age, and we are certain people are born in different places and different cultures according to their karma. According to the karma, you get not only a body, but you inherit the thoughts and the outlook of your previous birth. So persons who are born in Kali Yuga, who get the human birth in Kali Yuga, generally it's because they have this grossly materialistic outlook. Although some are born because they have a highly spiritual outlook. So this is the reason, due to the influence of the age. That's one reason. We can say that's a major reason. Actually, ascertaining cause is one of the major points of Vedic philosophy. What is the cause? And we'll find that for any event or any undertaking, there are usually several causes. Just like, for instance, if we see, this is a classic example in Vedic philosophy. What is the cause of the pot? Well, we could say the cause is the earth, because that's what makes the pot. But another cause is the potter who makes the pot. And then another cause we can say is the potter's family, because he has to maintain them and that's why he makes the pot. And then another cause is the person who wants the pot to use for carrying water or whatever. So there are various causes. So it's quite a complex subject. I think we'll finish here. It seems to be getting a little late. The sun is setting, which indicates that the day is coming to an end. That's another profound statement. So we'll finish here. Hare Krishna. So yeah, I have a few books here.